Broadcasting from deep within the second realm, you are listening to agoristradio.com.
Hello, this is Hero White of the Cypherpunk Show. Agoristradio.com is sponsored by MetroPie.net, SSH proxy and VPN services. Privacy is your right, only if you defend it. Please support our sponsors and tell others about them.
I know you're out there. I can feel you now. I know that you're afraid. You're afraid of us. You're afraid of change. I don't know the future. I didn't come here to tell you how this is going to end. I came here to tell you how it's going to begin. I'm going to hang up this phone, and then I'm going to show these people what you don't want them to see. I'm going to show them a world without you. A world without rules and controls, without borders or boundaries. A world where anything is possible.
Hello and welcome back to another episode of Cypherpunked. Today we have a special guest with us, Jonathan Logan, and we are going to be covering the topic of Hawala. Jonathan, are you there?
I am here. Hello. Thank you for having me on.
Yeah, it's great to have you on. Let's see, you are well known in some of these cypherpunk circles that I happen to bump into. You're known crypto anarchist working in black IT. Oh, that's great. And author of Second Realm, this book that's... why don't you give us an intro real quick, what Second Realm is about?
Sure. Second Realm is a book on the specific strategy that I personally favor, on how to get a little bit more liberty in our lifetimes and our lives. And that is by combining the different concepts from crypto-anarchy, panarchism, and mixing it up with physical things, things we can do in the non-virtual world, things like temporary autonomous zones, like communities of people, trading networks, trading posts where you can conduct business safely, and all that mixed together is what I termed the second realm. Because it's more or less, a world in itself, if it ever exists.
Okay, great. How does the philosophy and the activity of agorism tie in with the Second Realm?
There's an overlap between Second Realm and agorism, and the overlap is counter-economics. Mm-hmm. Underground trade, trade without having uninvited third parties in it.
Great. Well, we would like to have you on for another show to cover temporary autonomous zones and many of the issues covered in the Second Realm book. So we'll look forward to
sure.
that. So Hawala, quite an interesting subject and goes back in history quite a bit and is quite controversial today. And we see computer software, networking, and the digital cash systems tying together today in this direction. What can you tell us about Hawala?
Correct. Well, Hawala in itself is something like a method. It's a way to transfer value from point A to B. Where it exactly started is unknown. It's probably... the term comes from the 9th century, as far as I know, and it means to change or to transmit. And essentially, it's a network for value transfer that is based on trust networks, on families, on business partners. And basically, it allows you to send money Just by, you know, going by to your local Havala dealer, the Havalada, and give him money and tell him, okay, I'd like that money to be in a different location, and be picked up by a friend or something. And this Havala dealer will then take my money, usually give me an identification code, which is usually just a number or a word, and call up his peer, who's in the location I want the money at, and tell him, okay, please give so-and-so much money to whoever shows up and tells you the number or gives you the secret word. So that is more or less what it is. And it's really a way of moving money through an informal network that is not structured, complicated like our banking system. It's not under oversight. It's not leaving that much of a paper trail, and so on and so on. And it's been a very old method to do things like that. Actually, the first signs of networks like that to exist are from the times of Christ, where business partners that traveled along simply carried money or sent money for friends. So that is where it comes from.
I have heard some reference to the Knights Templar. Can you tell us anything about that?
The Knights Templar, the intersection with Havala is more or less in the business of moving money. The Knights Templar, being a religious military order of the 1100 till 1300, something like that, they actually invented something like banking, or made it widely available to pilgrims going to the Holy Land, to Palestine. And essentially what they did, they took money at a local place where the pilgrim departed from, and safe kept that money and issued a letter of credit for that. And the pilgrim, when he would arrive in Jerusalem, he would present that letter of credit to the local station of the Templars and get his money back minus some fees. And the reason they did it is that travel back in those days was not so very safe. You can think about it like the TSA being at every crossing and patting you down. And back then they were called robbers. And that was really something, you know, not safe. And the Knights Templars, when they were founded, their mission that they took on from themselves was to protect the pilgrims. That was, you know, what they were founded for. So one of the things they did to do that was to help pilgrims not to have too much money with them, so they aren't robbed. Or if they're robbed, they're not losing everything they need. Right. That is where the intersection comes from.
Great. Now, back at what time, or do you know the extent that Havala has been used in past centuries? Was it a somewhat historically documented phenomenon throughout the world, or was it primarily in Europe, Asia? Do you know the historical uses?
Havala as a network of transferring money has existed for at least 1,000 years. And it hasn't been called that name all the time.
Right.
And it wasn't as extensive and as fast as it is today. Personally, I think that the big time of Havala started after World War II, where more people from Arabic and Islamic countries emigrated to the U.S., to Europe, and so on. And they needed more of that to send money back to their families to support them. So that is, I think, the number of transactions went up after that. Before that, it was always a system used by traders, by merchants. So when you had to carry your salt from point A to point B, you would probably use Havala to settle some of the costs. Or even the Western merchants used Havala-like systems to make payments amongst each other for shipments. So it's hard to really separate Havala from all the other networks that existed in the same time and region, because they all intermingled.
Okay. So today, who is using Havala right now in a, not necessarily talking about in the alternate economy, but, or, you know, in the agorist type communities and like, but right now as a general practice, as a little side note here, I was watching a clip. I walked into the room while someone was watching that Indian movie. It was real big, Slumdog Millionaire or something. I walked in the room, and on the screen flashed for a fraction of a second a guy walking in a busy street by some merchants, and on the side of one of the buildings, it actually said Havala. And
right.
It was just a scene. I never caught it again, but it was interesting. So I hear that they're still doing this in India and parts of like Saudi Arabia, Dubai. I'm not sure. Are you familiar where this is mainstream right now, even whether it's legal? Well, first, where it's legal and it's the normal way of doing it, and where it may not be legal, but it is still mainstream.
Yeah, first of who uses Havala. Havala is mostly used by people wanting to send money home. That is where the West got into Havala, so to speak. And by merchants, they use it to make payments for shipments amongst each other. Those are probably the two big client bases that Havala has. And Havala, there are a few places on the planet where Havala is really, really big, like where there are streets of Havala dealers, or where Havala dealers even publicly announce what they do. Mm-hmm. And Dubai is pretty famous for it, though there has been some crackdown on Havala, basically asking people to license themselves. Another thing is India. India is pretty big on it. Pakistan, Afghanistan, Iran has some good Havala presence in Egypt, and so on. It's mostly something that is in the Arab culture, plus parts of Asia, even places like Thailand and Hong Kong. You will find Havaladers. They're not always called that way. For example, in India, you will most likely find something called a Hundi, which is a Havala dealer, but just, you know, in their language.
Okay.
Or in Pakistan, I think it's Saraf or something like that. So there are different names for the same thing. When it comes to the West, places with a lot of immigrants, okay. Immigrants from the Arabic nations are big, like London, for example, New York, Paris, and so on and so on.
Okay. Now, these things are, if we would compare it into something that would be similar, where you walk in, throw cash on the table, send some money to a receiver, and you get a little reference code like Western Union or MoneyGram. Western Union is a centralized system where they have an international network where agents are tied in with their little terminals and their logo on the front. It's not independent operations. They're actually working with their terminals. And the Havala system, though, it's somewhat distributed. Now, there, give us an idea of some of these structures. I mean, I can imagine that there are some families that have relatives in different cities, and then they work within their own network, and then there may be families that have special links with each other and trust each other, or other businesses, or is this family run, or are there individual business interests that tend not to be family oriented in some places?
The core of Havala is family and trusted business partners. So most Havalaers are not full-time Havalaers. So it's the Havala business is a side business for something else they do.
Okay.
In most cases. So you have something like an import-export company that imports food from, let's say, India to England, and you do this, and you also do Havala, for example. Mm-hmm. So the core is actually trust based on family ties, so uncles, cousins, nephews, whatever. So that is the link. So you have someone from the family living in Mumbai and the other part living in London, and they trust each other because they're from the same family.
Right.
And because they trust each other, they can essentially run a credit-based system on each other and settle it somewhere in the future by the trade that they're doing as well. So,
for example,
they undercharge or overcharge for shipments to settle the books. Uh-huh. And that is the core. There are a few families that have actually specialized on Havala. There are some clans, and I think the main focus on that is for Paris, and I think part of it's in Germany, where there are a few family clans that run Havala as a big business. The other thing is that there are people with existing business relationships that trust each other. Mm-hmm. And that is not as frequent, but that is maybe the number three when it comes to size of Havala. However, one shouldn't look at Havala as one integrated system.
Right.
Like when you're using Western Union, you could send something from Western Union New York station to Western Union Paris without an issue, and you could do it for every Western Union station around. With Havala, you rely on there being connections or trust relationships between the place you want to send from and the place you want to receive. And Havala is often just a single step transactions. They're not routing their money, or at least they don't like it, and it gets more expensive. Still being cheap, but you know, it's not built for that. It's not for routing money. It's for putting money in at one place, and at another place where there's a trusted party, the money is given to you again. So it's not as flexible as Western Union, but it's cheaper. It's actually more reliable. And it is unregulated, which means that you get better exchange rates and stuff like that. And there's no paper trail.
Okay, so back up a little bit, because you mentioned several things there. If you had a street of Havala dealers, there may be some that specialize more in that actually have connections in South America. You may want to hit those rather than the other ones who specialize in Eastern Europe or something.
Yes.
Right. So
yes, that's what you would do.
Great. Can you give us an idea on pricing differences for that you have seen or heard for, let's say, larger amounts of money, like around, let's just say $1,000 as a general example, compared to Western Union or compared to doing some type of a SWIFT or interbank transfer?
Okay. $1,000 is actually a good example because most Havala transfers are not very big. So we're talking about less than $5,000 for most transfers, simply because immigrants are people living in foreign countries. The money they send is usually in small numbers. Usually a havalader will charge something like between a quarter of a percent and a percent for his services itself. Mm-hmm. And on the other hand, you have the exchange rates for the money you send. So if you're sending US dollars and you want to get dinar out there, you have often better exchange rates when it comes to Havala, usually because they settle their accounts internally and they're not so much into currency regulations. So you're saving on the exchange rate as well. For Western Union, I'm not sure what the prices are currently, but if you're looking at an international Swift transfer, the prices there, you would be somewhere between 40 and 60 US dollars for a thousand US dollars you send from the US to someplace in India. The problem, however, is, if you want to do a Swift transfer or if you want to do a Western Union transfer, there's more to it than just the money you have to pay. And one of the things is you cannot do SWIFT without having bank relationships. So if you're a so-called illegal immigrant, having a banking relationship is a real issue. So you cannot easily use SWIFT. And you might not be able to use Western Union simply because they want to see the papers. So Havala is cheaper because it requires less from you. It doesn't require a banking relationship. It often requires no passport or anything. It's a cash-only, very informal, fast, and no-question-asked business. So that is a cost that many people often forget. And that is what makes Havala really big, is for immigrants, it's much easier to trust someone from their own country and someone who's not asking for stupid papers, to do the banking.
Right. And they can expose themselves for other liabilities if their visa or passport are expired, or, I don't know,
exactly.
Different countries have, you know, reporting the things that they are knowing, you know, watching their customers and reporting or, you know, filling out paperwork and the like. Now, do you have any
empty?
Go ahead.
And the other thing is the receivers. I mean, you want to send your mother in Afghanistan $1,000. How many people in Afghanistan have a bank account, or in Pakistan, or in India? Only very, very few people have access to banking at all, or to licensed banking. So even if you wanted to do it with your legal passport and with everything else, you know, you have all your things together, you often cannot do it, because the receiving side is cut off from the international banking system.
Mm-hmm. You know, a little side tidbit here. I read an article a few years ago talking about the unbanked in the United States, and I don't remember the numbers, but it was the numbers were staggering, and the article was talking about how financial service companies can tap into this market for people who don't have bank accounts and the like. And there are this massive number of people in the U.S. that are, you know, they were calling them the forgotten. But what you have to think about is these people are not people that don't have money and don't do business. They're just not doing it in that system because, well, if they don't have a bank account and ATM cards and debit cards and, you know, they're not plugging into it, then they're doing something else. So,
right.
Do you have any idea on the amount of transfers that are happening internationally in the system?
Many thousand a day. It's hard to really say how many transfers are going on and how much money they move. I'm pretty sure it's per day in the range of several million. Think about it. You have hundreds of thousands of people from Hawala countries living abroad, and they all want to send money back to their families,
right?
Because they love them and want to support them. So this is quite a big number of people using those systems, and maybe not using them for huge transfers, but using them often. So it's not small. It's lots of money that goes through those pipes. Plus that you have a lot of trading going through there, merchants paying other merchants for shipments, which can be sizable amounts.
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, if you import carpets from Iran or something, you might actually pay with Hawala instead of making a Swift transfer, which might actually be held up forever. So,
right,
yeah.
Right. You know, back to the cost issue, in many of these countries, it's not uncommon for the average working person to have an income of $1 a day. So when you have
Yep.
someone working in a foreign country who's making $20 a day, and
Yes.
they at the end of the week, they do a $100 transfer back to their family. If they're using the, a Swift system or a MoneyGram Western Union, the chunk that is taken out of that is huge. It's completely
Absolutely.
Cost prohibitive just from that a money amount.
Absolutely.
And then you have this massive number of people that are actually doing this. This system is just it's the only system that's possible for them without them getting
Absolutely.
Completely ripped off. You know, you think of the story of the money changers getting kicked out for theft, and you look at what they're trying to force these people to do to use their system with these massive margins and for what they do. You know, when
Right.
you do the Western Union, you're they're not taking that money and then give it to someone else and then having an armored truck come over and pick it up the next day and transfer it to this end location.
Right, they clear it through the banking system.
Right.
So it's actually cheap what Western Union does. Yes, absolutely. I mean, I see Hapala or Yundi or whatever there is. They are probably one of the fundamental things to help those countries or the people in those countries. Actually, I don't care about the countries, but the people
right.
in the countries,
mm-hmm.
Because of those systems and because of their family abroad supporting them, they survive. And they're better off in a year than they were 2 years ago. So that is it's helping them a lot. Mm-hmm. It's a relief mission that is probably much bigger than anything any state ever came up with.
Yeah, right. Yes, and usually these
and
relief missions are just sending large chunks of cash to some politically connected or purely political organization, which divvies it up from there. We're talking about
and it wasn't the first time
going to these people. Oh, sorry, go ahead.
And the money that the state sends in relief efforts has been stolen in the first
exactly.
place. So, yeah, talking about state relief versus people helping each other on a voluntary basis.
Yeah, this is great. I had not considered these numbers and what they mean for these people and seeing it as a relief type thing, the way that it works out like that. You know, you talk
it
about
absolutely.
Counter. These people are doing these things, and I've seen this with articles and some videos and there's documentation on this in the Second Realm book. These informal markets and this counter market activity that is happening worldwide on a massive scale, by people who have no end goal of achieving more liberty. They're just doing actions on the ground to achieve more liberty, to protect their assets and to do trade and to hide their money from people who would want to take large chunks of it or just outright steal it from them. And they may not even understand the concept of individual sovereignty and sometimes, you know, pure the pure concept of private property. And they're doing these things that are things that the agorists and you talk about in your Second Rome book, that these concepts of, hey, you know, stop using. If you're upset with the central bank, with the Federal Reserve, instead of trying to change it and complaining about the rates and what they're doing with the dollar and the like, use an alternative currency, use alternative money transfer systems, and people are going, hey, that's a great idea. Well, these people are already doing it. They're already doing black market stuff, even though they may not have those philosophical foundations.
No, I mean, they're just doing it because they have problems to be solved, and they don't care about what the state or the society says so much. And there are networks like that that are ages old and still operational. However, I think that one of the problems we have as people wanting more liberty is that in many ways we have forgotten how liberty really works, because things like the Havala system or things like the Knights Templars or whatever, they were not regulated by a third party, and so everyone dealing with them had to go into negotiation with them themselves. Mm-hmm. And to build something like trust,
Because they weren't certified
to rely on. Right, they were not certified, they weren't licensed, there was no oversight, so to speak, or is no oversight. So it's all about trust, it's about honor, it's about loyalty. And sometimes when I look at the history of banking, and especially in the last 150 years, or history of states in itself, I think that the state replaced our very human ways of doing stuff. Mm-hmm. By artificially making us into children. So many people today call the police when their neighbor has loud music, instead of, you know, simply going there and say, hey, would you please turn down the music a little bit? Mm-hmm. So we don't know how to negotiate anymore. We don't know how to build long-term trusting relationships in business. We don't have a sense of honor anymore. We don't have loyalty that we spend on people. So that has all been uneducated by the state. The state basically comes in and says, I am the one you have to trust, and I make sure that trust is well invested in me. Mm-hmm. And we all know where it goes. But in a way, it's simpler to do it through the state. It's a central system. You only have to deal with one party, so to speak. And so people, out of not knowing better, not having learned better, or of laziness maybe, rely on the state. But when you go into third world countries, where the state is not someone you trust. It's mm-hmm. not someone who's even pretending to be in working in your favor. Then it's a very different thing. People grow up knowing that the state, well, it's there, you know, but you don't really trust it. It's all corrupt.
Right.
It's all messed up. And essentially, you go back to those places of trust that really deserve it. And that is family,
right.
Or religious communities, or networks of friends, network of business partners.
Mm-hmm.
And that is actually what drives liberty far more than much of our talk, is building relationships. Mm-hmm. And building relationships that can be used for good business. So if I can trust my business partner to really give the 5,000 euros to a friend who's in need, then I have circumvented 1,000 banks in between and 1,000 laws in between and so on and so on. I have made liberty happen already.
Right.
So, and that doesn't require much. It's just requiring people honoring their agreements and not giving you up to the state.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, those are really great points. You know, I heard was hearing that the other day. There's a story in the U.S. right now about a guy in out in the East who had 5 complaints be filed against him for a basketball hoop, one of those portable ones that he had in his yard out by the street, and the state planner guy, I mean the city planner guy, came over and they brought the police chief, sheriff or whatever, and they were ordering this guy and forcing him to remove his basketball hoop, and they were talking about, you know, who complained, and in one of the guys that was talking about this incident, he talked about something similar that happened to him, about somebody complaining about something out on his front lawn, and he had to go to court for it, and he could not find out. Oh, he wanted to know who complained. They asked the person. They made a phone call. The person that complained said they did not want to be known. They wanted to remain anonymous, and he did not find out until he was in court. So people have, you know, when you talk about laziness, there's another aspect here. A lot of times it's cowardice, because they would rather, instead of negotiating with somebody, you know, if your music's too loud, you know, and the guy's having his 50th, he just turned 50 and he's having a big party with his family and it's late, you know, you go over and ask him about the music. Maybe he says, give me another couple hours and then I'll turn it off or cut off the, you know,
or come over and have a drink with us, you know, party with us.
Yes,
and
exactly.
We'll enjoy the music.
Uh-huh. And yeah, people don't do that. They think, I'll call the police. I'll be anonymous. He'll have no idea it's me. And a guy will come out with guns and threaten him with force.
I think there's another thing to it, and that is the state is essentially a bullying service. You know, it's a bully from school that you have been or someone else has been, you know, and now you have the power yourself. You have the biggest bully available, you know, that you can send after people that you don't like. David Brins once said that if he could, we all be tyrants, and it doesn't speak well of him. But I think that many people are. Many people are trained into a way of thinking and dealing with people that is about being a bully, being not nice, being a coward. And that is basically the biggest achievement that the state ever made. It's destroying the foundation of human society. And things like the Havala Network are examples of how human society can work if people try to live by different values. Mm-hmm. If they try to live by values like honor, trust, keeping your agreements, being helpful. I mean, those Havaladers, they are helpful. They help people. They even save lives. I mean, sending a few hundred dollars to Pakistan might save someone's life, because there will be someone more having food on the table.
Yeah,
so,
simple medical care.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. And instead of applauding those people and saying what you're doing is great, you know, and that you do it without, you know, relying on a bully that pays for his guns by stealing money from other people, they do it themselves. So essentially, we should applaud them and support them and use their methods, because what they demonstrate is how humans can work if they want to, instead of the shit we have in most of the Western world right now.
That's great. You know, why is Hawala demonized, and in what ways have you seen it demonized in the West
There have been several attempts to demonize Havala. It didn't start with 9/11. It started before that. But Havala has been demonized officially for two reasons. And that is participating in money laundering and participating in tax evasion. And after 9/11, it was banking built for terrorism.
Okay.
Because when you're using Havala, the Havala dealer will not, do the state's bidding and, make sure that everything is recorded correctly so that the state will know how much money to take from you or to look where your money went to and so on and so on. Mm-hmm. So that is the official talk when it comes to why Havala is bad. I think that a lot of that comes from two different sources. One of the sources is, of course, people loving the state and wanting to make sure that everything is neatly licensed, regulated, oversought, and crushed. Okay. So that is one of the places where it comes from. Another big thing is that the competition doesn't like Havala. Mm-hmm. So companies like Western Union have been known to have smear campaigns against Havala in Dubai, where they try to keep people away from doing Havala and instead use Western Union by making false claims. Mm-hmm. And of course they do it because they want to tap into the money that there is, because it's a big business. If you set that up on a global scale and calculate it through, we're talking a lot about, lots of money you could make as Western Union if you can make sure that your competition is, not in place anymore. And of course, it's good for the bankers as well. Havala has the problem of not coming up with statistics. And statistics on currency flows are something you need if you want to be a very successful forex trader or something like that. Mm-hmm. So there are a lot of people that are a little bit pissed off because they don't get a share. And that combined, people that want to the state, to be powerful, combined with the competition, that is what drove the fight against Havala. However, the fight has not been very successful. Mm-hmm. There have been a lot of talks about making Havala legal, even in the U.S., Havala dealers being able, to get a license as a money transmitting business. And yes, they have to fill out forms and stuff like that, but not too many of them complied, because they don't really want to play with the state if they don't have to. Mm-hmm. For good reasons. It would drive up the cost of the operation. It would make you liable in so much many more ways. So it's still an ongoing thing. I don't think it's as big anymore as it has been in 2002 or 2003. But the battle is still out there. And the usual suspects are fighting it from, once in a while.
Right. How do you see what's happening in the current financial meltdowns around the world with the value of currencies and the tightening of restrictions on some places are starting up capital flow restrictions, and we're seeing things start to change in a bigger way right now. Do you see Havala taking a bigger role with a lot of this stuff that can be happening over the next couple of years? If we're talking bad things happening, let's assume that they are coming in the next several years in the banking system, economy.
I'd bet on worse things coming. Let's drop the term Havala, because Havala is a very specific system. Let's talk about informal value transfer.
Okay.
Yes, I think that informal value transfer systems will become much bigger. And some of them will be even better than Havala. Havala has an issue. You have to go to the Havalader or have a relationship with him before you can do much business. And he might turn you down because he doesn't trust you. Mm-hmm. So I think that there is a lot of place for improvement there to make Havala more secure, to make Havala better for people that are not in the ethnic community that it serves. Mm-hmm. And I think that in certain ways we have to go back to those very old ways of doing business and money transfer, so we can outrun the state and survive his collapse. So yes, I think informal value transfers will be something of the future. I mean, there are so-called over the table exchangers in several cities around the world where you can buy digital cash for, you know, simply going into a business, to a shop or to a cafe or whatever, and you know, meet the right guy, give him a few thousand, and you'll have instantly settled digital currency on your right. On your account. Mm-hmm. And you can use that to pay other people, and then he can use the same method to get the money out. You know, go to a guy and sit down with him and say, okay, I'll give you so much money digital, and you give it to me cash. And that is something that is still very small. There are not too many people doing that, but there's a lot of power in it.
There is, and I can see a huge market popping up for this as the awareness for this comes about and the number of people entering in using these alternate currencies and the like is, you know, if you're, like you said, for the people that are running the Hawala systems, that they're typically not only a Hawala deal. They have another business, and this is something they do on the side right. because of their connections and relationships. So I can see, you know, thousands of people throughout, well, in way more than thousands, but for this example, thousands of people throughout the world, they think, hey, look at this. I can have a couple thousand dollars in a particular alternate currency, digital currency online, and I can, with only $1,000 in there, I can sell that and buy it and yes. sell it and buy it. I can go through $20,000 worth of exchanges in one day based upon only having $1,000 yeah. investment in the system.
Well, maybe not that much. Because for that you already need quite a few customers and yeah. people knowing that they can come to you. Plus, you have to make sure that your books are netting out. Right. So it's actually not, you know, the volume might be a little bit lower, but still it's something you can do. It's something basically everyone can do. It's a pretty simple business if you know a little bit about, you know, bookkeeping for yourself, and a little bit about your personal security, because it's not the wisest thing to stand around at a street corner with lots of cash in your pockets, you know, and advertising your over the table exchanging. So mm-hmm. It's not trivial, but it's not hard. It's nothing you need to study for, so to speak. Right. But you have to be an honorable person. You have to mm-hmm. be a person people can trust. And that is something, reputation is something that is built over time. So that is actually the real investment you have to make, not the money that you have on both sides of the system,
right.
but the reputation that you have to have.
Right. Well, there's a lot of people out there selling a lot of products that aren't necessarily legal right now, and they have their own networks for doing these things, and they have a risk level, their threat model is much higher because of the contraband products that they may be exchanging
yes.
for cash. If you think of that global network and then move it over, and just to create an analogy here, imagine them, instead of selling some contraband, they're actually just selling a code on a piece of paper. They're selling the digital.
Right.
Okay. So they have no contraband. Right. They're just accepting money like they're already doing now. And instead of possessing an illegal contraband, they're just giving out a number. I can see.
Well, the number will be illegal then, but who cares?
Well, yes. Right. But, you know, if the guy just reads it off to the other guy and then, you know, I know what you're saying. But, yeah, they'll make the numbers legal. But the problem today is actual possession of the contraband, not of of a specific number. So if the profit margins for the guy taking the cash are similar, yet the risk is much lower, I can see, and the need even being possibly even greater, the demand of, by people, you know, on the streets, in working people, and we're talking in it when there's problems with the economy, or you're in you're going in tyrannical mode worldwide, and there's such a serious crackdown, but the economies are bad, and people are really trying to do business and other things under the table and in the alternate markets, informal markets, and the like so common in Central South and America and Asia, so much more than right. You know, the U.S. The extent of that in the U.S. is typically a garage sale or something during the summer for most people.
Right.
Or
but there's a big difference. There's a big difference in those countries. And the difference is, as someone living in Egypt or in Saudi Arabia or whatever, the percentage of people that are self-employed, you know, having their own shops, their own business, is much bigger.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so if you are employed at a big company, you don't have access to those systems. You cannot use them because the big company will already place the money into a regulated bank account.
Right.
So it's really the people that have control over their own business that can use those technologies or those methods. And so many people will actually not be able to use it because they, by the contract they have with their company, by their job in itself, they will be already caught up in the net of the state regulated systems.
Right.
So it's a two step process. It's not just that systems like that are in place where we can have money liberated, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
But you already need some liberty in your own life to be able to use it,
mm-hmm.
Which is why many of the people sending money through Havala are either self-employed or they're so-called illegal aliens that, you know, are paid cash.
Mm-hmm.
So they are not in the system. And because they're not in the system, they have more freedom or more flexibility in going into a different system. So that is something one should keep in mind.
Mm-hmm.
If you're working in a 9-to-4 job or 9-to-5 job, and you get your money with a wire transfer, you'll have a hard time, bugging out of that system and going to freedom.
Yeah, or if you're an employee for the big corporation, and they give you the payment, you're going to get screwed on the front end. And then
right.
What you have left over after you pay all your other expenses and the like, then, you know, that's your peanuts.
Taxes,
that you have to
whatever.
to play and participate in the alternate system, which a lot of people are doing right now. They can't get out of the old system because of certain obligations and commitments and needs that they have, but they're starting up alternate agorist or other businesses on the side and looking at moving more into that until they can lower their cost of living and the like to so they can support themselves in the alternate system. And, you know, when you look at everything that you save and then cut out stuff that you don't need, you start to see how much not just money you have, but then liberty with your own time and pursuing your own desires. It's great.
Right. Right. You have to combine both.
Mm-hmm.
You have to liberate your life. And when you do so, you will find new ways to liberate specific areas of your life, like your money dealings.
Mm-hmm. Well, Jonathan, we're coming up on the hour here. I want to give out a few references. You listeners can go to www.secondrealm.net, and on there, there is a link. What is the link for getting the URL for the ebook, Second Realm, a book on strategy?
There's a link on the bottom. It says the book. When you click on it, you'll have several download options.
Okay. There's a PDF and other options, and this is...
Yeah, there's EPUB and something like that, so you can read it on your digital book reader.
Yeah, this is an absolutely fantastic book, highly recommended, must read for anyone who's looking at achieving more freedom in their lives. It's a book on strategy, covers many concepts, ideas, and it will stretch your mind far and wide and give you a lot of fantastic ideas to pursue and resource material for pursuing that. Also, there's a link on there for accessing the Agora channel. It's an IRC chat network. And
right.
We will... Anything you'd like to say before we close this up?
Yes, one thing. If you want freedom, freedom is about what you do yourself, not what you make others to do for you.
Very good. Thank you very much, Jonathan, for coming on the show. And we hope to have you back to cover some of these other Second Realm topics very soon. This was a lot of fun, very informative, and I enjoyed it. So thank you.
Thank you. I enjoyed it as well. Thank you.
Yep. Goodbye.
Bye.
Thanks, everybody, for listening today. And come back tomorrow for another great show. We'll be covering another one of the digital cash systems out there that's under development. And on Friday, we have a special episode with another special guest that we're going to cover Bitcoins. Friday will be Bitcoin Mania. Take care, everybody.
Dodge this.
This is Hero White of the Cypherpunk Show. AgoristRadio.com is sponsored by MetroPie.net, SSH proxy and VPN services. Privacy is your right, only if you defend it. Please support our sponsors and tell others about them.
Broadcasting from deep within the Second Realm, you are listening to AgoristRadio.com.